Hello, folks. Welcome to another episode of Long Shots with my usual suspect, Mr. Sharad Tupran. Hey, Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very well. We've taken a little bit of a break, but we've started off strong this season.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a litigating lawyer with us today. This is, I think, the third time we have someone from the legal profession.
Yeah, third or fourth. I mean, including...
Kushan was there. And anyways,
yeah.
It's really exciting to have Sonali Malhotra with us today. And before we kind of, you know, jump into the conversation, Sonali has been a litigating lawyer for almost now 18 years. And she's based out of Delhi. She's a Delhi product from day one, studied at LSR. After that was doing her LLB law in DU. Then she went to National Law University. And after that, she's been part of Sunil Malhotra & Associates Law Chamber for most of her career. And her area of expertise is ranging from commercial law to family law to matrimonial law. So litigation is pretty much in her blood. So it's very exciting to have her here. And welcome, Sonali. Thanks so much,
Nikhil. Thanks, Sharad, for having me here. It's quite exciting to be here in your podcast.
No, absolutely. It's our pleasure. And, you know, I mean, even before we actually started recording, you were talking about how litigation is so different from corporate law.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think that's there's a difference of dynamic. There's a difference of lifestyle. How did you kind of jump into this?
Yes, that's actually a very interesting story, Nikhil, which I would like to share with you guys and with everybody else, because perhaps I feel that, you know, maybe my story might have a little bit of an influence on the younger generation. Some of them may feel encouraged to be a part of litigation, like I say, being a litigating lawyer. So basically, it was more of a given that, you know, I belong to a family of lawyers.
Right.
So therefore, I was a third generation. And so I did law, which seemed a very obvious choice for me after I finished economics from LSR.
Okay.
Yeah, but then, yes, I would also say that one personal aspect of my life was that I was an only child. And like, you know, we have these sibling fights and all that. So I never had that. So in fact, my relatives would say that, you know, she cannot do litigation because she cannot argue.
Hmm.
But I actually feel that it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something which, you know, we prepare and then, you know, we kind of get attuned to argue for our clients. So that's something totally different. I would also say that people who really argue as siblings don't become like hardcore litigators when they grow up.
Yeah, right.
And people who are only children can actually end up being litigating lawyers.
Right.
Yeah, but the story goes like this, that when I was quite young, I think I got really exposed to hearing a lot of words related to law. Because consider me in that way, that when I was in my 80s, when we were in 1980s, and I was in my, say, a 10-year-old at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there were no mobile phones, nothing like that. There were normal landlines. And sometime a client would call up on a home landline and I would hear my dad say, yeah, we have got a status quo. And we have to go in for an appeal. So when I was just a 10-year-old, I heard words like status quo, appeal and so on and so forth. So you got used to those terminologies and perhaps understand the intensity of all that. And in the most commonest of the manner. But yes, as I grew up, I still carry those thoughts in my mind when I am in the court. I still remember, perhaps, to a certain extent, the seriousness on my father's face when, you know, these kind of things used to happen.
Yeah.
And why I'm discussing all this is because I feel that as a third generation lawyer, I definitely had the advantages of being born and brought up in a law family, if I may say. Of course, you know, when I started the profession, I had a platform. I had files to work on from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't have to really garner all that, you know,
say
garnering clients or garnering files and all that. I had all that, if I may use the word, on the platter.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, I also feel that when you come from a law family or if you are a third generation lawyer, then I had a lot of responsibility again from day one.
Mm.
It was more like, you know, about the client, about the case.
Right.
It was very serious right from day one. And I understood that most important in our profession is hard work, sincerity, and a lot of effort and, you know, willingness to do for your client, maybe say whether it is researching, whether it is mastering the facts, whether it is understanding the law, whether it is trying to explain the law in the best possible manner to the honorable courts. So it was always a very, very serious affair.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because, I mean, there's a human angle, right, here,
yes,
which is very heavy.
Absolutely.
And which kind of differs from corporate law, where it's much more transactional.
Yes.
But like, if you like look at, I mean, if you like kind of take a step back,
yeah,
and look at legal practice as a whole, especially,
yeah,
litigation.
That's right.
Right. I mean, how do you break that value chain in the sense that who are the different quote unquote operators? Obviously, there are law chambers,
yeah,
there are litigators.
That's right.
You know, often work standalone. I mean, Kushan, I think, spoke about it. I remember.
Yeah.
When he kind of, you know, when we had him a few months back. But it's always good to kind of, you know, understand that in the entire judicial value chain,
that's
where,
right,
do different cogs actually fit?
Yeah. So basically, Nikhil, you're absolutely correct. So Sharad, there is a difference in a law chamber. There is a difference in a law firm. And like, obviously, there are in-house legal people as well. And I believe that what happens eventually is that, I guess that I've observed that perhaps our mindsets are also a little different.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would first of all obviously like to talk about, say, a person like me who has a law chamber, who works in a law chamber. So, you know, like you said, actually the entire chain starts from there. There's a major amount of humane angle. So therefore what happens is that right from day one, it's not that, you know, we, like you initially when you introduced me, I am doing corporate work, but
right,
that's something which generally can be observed by people by reading. So I would like to share more from the personal, as in from,
mm-hmm,
the personal client front. So the personal client has his stakes or her stakes, and they get very, very involved, or what should I say, they are very emotionally invested in the
right
case. Very emotionally invested. So, in fact, to explain this further, when I have a corporate client, or say, you know, I have these statutory organizations for whom I'm doing matters, so they are obviously also giving me the best of instructions, the best of feedback, the best of everything. But the obviously, the personal investment in the matter is not there.
Not there, right?
However, when you deal with these clients who have their personal cases, the amount, the, it seems as if it's like, at that time, I think you are like a doctor, if,
mm-hmm,
I may use that analogy.
Or a therapist.
So, or a therapist.
Yeah.
Yes, you actually
yeah
end up being a therapist sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you know, you feel that it's make or break. It's life or death for them.
Right.
So it's that serious, and it gets quite, I would say, taxing also at times.
Mm-hmm.
But then, yes, we have to go with the flow. And like I said, work very hard for the matters and so on.
Right.
So that's how it is.
But like in terms of like, say a client comes to you with a particular civil matter.
Right.
I mean, there's a dispute.
That's right.
At what stage do they come to you?
Yeah.
And once they come to you, obviously there will be some sort of a, you know, initiation.
That's right.
And from the initiation, there is some sort of an endpoint.
That's right.
Right. So
yeah,
if you can kind of just give a sense of what is a typical journey of
yeah
a client.
That's right.
Starting from someone like you.
Yeah.
Till the matter is closed.
That's right.
Positive or negative,
yeah,
that's a different matter altogether.
Right,
but yeah,
right, right. So, yeah. So therefore, when a client comes to us, now let us assume again a person. We are not talking about companies.
Yes.
So, first of all, I think as a litigating lawyer, our job starts from hearing his story.
Correct.
If I would say, and hearing his entire thing. And I'm talking about, say, let me take an example of a property matter, for
right
instance. It could be something to do with succession. It could be something that he has done a property deal, or he's got stuck or something like that. So therefore, in that case, what happens is that basically you first understand the facts, and from the facts, you're able to gather that you kind of start strategizing in your mind as a lawyer that what is the forum which
mm
will be adopted for him,
mm,
and what is the kind of case which will be adopted for him.
Mm.
Now, every case may not just start immediately from the court. You might have to give a legal notice in
mm
that matter. So you then come to the second stage, therefore, of, see, first, I would say that when the client is meeting us at the first stage, he's just talking normally in whichever language he's comfortable. Talking
right
about Delhi, it can be English, Hindi, Punjabi, it can be anything.
Yeah.
And he's just talking normally. The client would always be a layman, but then, you know, he's just talking normally, the first kind of the prima facie view, which you get
right
of a case.
Right.
Second stage, then, when you think, let me assume a case where you have to give a legal notice. So therefore, then, as a lawyer, you start thinking, okay, now, so what will be the points of his case, which will be very essential for us, and which will actually build up his case,
mm-hmm,
you know, rather, all the essential important ingredients of his matter. And then what happens is that you actually start kind of taking instructions from him. Instructions is a key word here, I would say, because whenever, if you would also notice, if you would have ever seen a legal notice, God forbid you from any legal notice, but if you've generally had a look at a legal notice, it always is under the instructions of my client.
Right.
So that's when the client starts giving instructions, and there are some clients who are very wise, who are able to actually pen it down for you and give it to you on paper. Then there's some clients who like to just say it out to you and you kind of pen it down or have it penned down in your office and so on. So that's the second stage. Then the stage comes of actually choosing the forum. So now the forums are chosen as per the territorial jurisdiction, as per the pecuniary jurisdiction, and as per the subject matter jurisdiction. Now these are like hardcore law words which I'm using, but basically what I mean is that there are matters which are financially more than 2 crores. So those are filed straight away in the Delhi High Court. So I'm talking basically of normal civil matters right now. So, and the matters which are less than 2 crores get filed into the district courts.
Okay.
And I'm again now clarifying, these are all non-commercial matters firstly I'm talking about. So it can be family, property and so on and so forth like that. So now when you talk about the matters below 2 crores, so they are have to go into various district courts which we have in Delhi. So that depends upon the area in which the person is and in which the defendant is residing, defendant is working, and so on. And therefore, you file the matter as per the territorial jurisdiction. Then coming to the, so you've kind of had a pecuniary jurisdiction, you have a territorial jurisdiction. And then the subject matter is that what kind of subject it is. Like, if I may also explain you, there are very interesting cases which are going on, which might be even where your office is, there might be some places here which are having rental of less than 3,500. Now, they are not normal properties coming under the Transfer of Property Act. They come under something called a Delhi Rent Control Act. So if I would explain to you, it is like rent jurisdiction or rent control jurisdiction, which is all over India, but state-wise. So we have a Delhi rent control jurisdiction. So now those are before a rent control tribunal. Therefore, the significance of a subject matter. So what subject matter it is, and therefore you choose the forum. And it can be sometimes a consumer case, which goes to the National Consumer Disputes Redressal Forum. So it can be sometimes an electricity case, which might go to something called APTEL. So there are various forums, various actually places to practice. So all that is now happening at stage two, where you're deciding forum, so on and so forth. Then stage three will be basically after, now I assume the notice period is done, so on and so forth. The client comes back, there is not a reply or a very frivolous reply, you have to eventually go to court. So then you kind of make the draft of the petition. And depending upon, again, those above three things, and accordingly, the petition gets filed. There are some matters in which court fee is nominal. There are some matters in which court fee is more. Court fee is not obviously the fee of the lawyer. Court fee is the fee which goes to the court. No, sometimes you have to really explain this to the client. That, you know, court fee is separate, lawyer fee is separate. So then you do all that, and then eventually the matter gets filed to the court. Now, this was when the matter starts. And now after that, we have a long procedure when the matter actually takes place in the court. So what it is, when we talk of, I think I should be explaining this as well, in short, that what it is when the matter is there in the courts. So therefore, at the first stage is the notice stage, when you have to convince the honorable courts why a notice should be issued in a particular matter. And so after we cross this that stage, the other side has to come, file something called a reply, but it is called a written statement. And there is a particular time period within which it has to be done. And after that, there is a kind of a reply to the reply, which is called a replication, which is filed by the plaintiff, the person who filed the matter. After that, there are issues now. Issues will obviously be the issues which are disputed. Well, I said something, he said something. So now that's a dispute. So there are issues which are formulated by the honorable courts. And then you get into evidence stage. After the evidence is done, then the stage comes for the final argument. So it's a long drawn procedure, and we are led by something called a Code of Civil Procedure, which is called in short by lawyers as CPC. And that's very, very sacrosanct. And again, now something only specifically to the people in the law field, that we really, really must respect the CPC. And there are judgments, you know, talking about CPC, that it is, CPC is the procedural. So you know, so therefore it's a handmaid of justice. But otherwise, having said that also, CPC is very important. So you follow that and then that's how it is.
So,
yeah.
No, that's pretty interesting and, yes. And fairly detailed. So thanks for that. And I guess my question is, you know, you're a senior lawyer and you argue, you do all this. And basically, I get a sense, you know, there are three big pieces. One is sort of research and analysis on the matter.
Right.
Then there's process and logistics.
Yes.
And the third is, I guess, arguing, right?
Yes, absolutely.
In this entire process, like, how much of it is a team effort? Like, I'm sure you have your colleagues who are helping you on a matter, right?
Yeah.
How do you structure that? Because there are so many things moving.
That's right.
And you've described one matter. I'm sure you're working on multiple matters at the same time. I mean, sometimes you can mix up things also, right? I mean, but how do you sort of manage that environment? Because it's very multitask oriented, right?
That's right. Sure. Actually, very pertinent question in that sense. Because one day also, sometimes, you know, we have a couple of matters lined up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting actually to see. I would rather want to invite you to just come in just one day of your lives to my office or to the court.
I would
and
love
just,
to
just see a lawyer's life, maybe from morning till the night. Actually, it's I think it stretches to at least 15 hours perhaps, but whatever. So therefore, what I mean to say is that it's quite interesting because the diary of a litigating lawyer, a civil litigating lawyer, is basically high court and district courts as well.
Right.
And so you firstly, I think every evening what we do is we actually look at our diary and we figure out that how are we going to manage the day.
Mm-hmm.
Because assume an X number of matters in all the courts. So suppose if I have to go to the court, so I will focus firstly on one court. Let's say if I'm deciding to go to the high court, then I have to assign my other colleagues for the other courts.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes what happens is that I may be required in another court as well for, say, some kind of a heavy argument. So then you kind of try to... So we have had... this is like a very usual thing for us. We say we start our day with high court. We do a couple of matters there. Then we say rush to another court. Maybe let's take Saket court.
Mm-hmm.
Then come back to high court
mm-hmm.
and then do argument there. So therefore, your question becomes very pertinent. Now, at one juncture, you are maybe arguing... property matter of, say, a son fighting against the father, for
mm-hmm.
instance. Then you are maybe doing a matrimonial matter, husband and wife having a dispute. Then maybe you come back and you do another kind of a property matter of a tenant and a landlord.
Yeah.
Then you might be just doing another matter, which is, again, a complete separate set of facts where there is a specific performance involved. Somebody paid money, did not get the property, and so on and so forth. So on one single day, you are actually doing multiple matters. But thankfully, Sharad, we don't get mixed up with facts.
Yeah.
Hmm.
It kind of remains in the system so well. And obviously, you keep on revising your facts all the time. So that is not there. And because I guess what happens with practice that because you are doing it day in and day out,
right.
So you get used to doing that.
Right.
So, and yes, I feel that multitasking becomes an essential part of a lawyer's life because...
Right.
Now, this was just an argument side of my life, say, from 10 to 4.
Yeah.
Then after that, you get back to the office and then you are doing a completely different thing.
Yeah.
Meeting clients also because that's the only time we get to meet clients.
Mm.
And again, like listening to them or something, sometimes hearing new cases, sometimes, you know, working on our older cases, sometimes ensuring that the research is done properly. So, yes, it becomes quite... I think a rainbow of cases or a rainbow of things which you do in a day.
Right. I mean, when you were, like you mentioned, engagement with clients.
That's
now,
right.
I assume that when you're looking at multiple matters, there's
yeah.
obviously a lot of internal dependencies with you and your colleagues,
that's
other
right.
people in the firm.
Yes.
But I'm guessing there are some external dependencies as well, right?
Yeah.
In the sense that, isn't it true that often law firms and litigants, they kind of work in different value chains?
That's
and
right.
I mean, I'm guessing a lot of clients are probably also referred to you by third parties.
That's right.
So, and a lot of guys must be just coming to you directly.
That's right.
So there are a lot of partners, I would imagine. What are the mechanics of that from a ground level perspective?
Yeah. So again, very interesting question, Nikhil. So here also your earlier question is getting very connected that, mine is a law chamber.
Correct.
So little different from a law firm.
Right.
So we don't have a concept of partnership.
Right.
So we have colleagues who are lawyers, who are again litigating lawyers. So that way, technically, I do not know, maybe some other law chambers may be functioning a little differently, but generally what happens in a law chamber is that other people are that way not having a financial stake per se in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not how it works.
Right.
Because then how it works is that everybody is like a kind of a part of your law chamber, which you are like kind of managing in that sense.
Yeah.
So therefore, the next perspective which comes is that the role of the other people in the chamber is definitely very significant and never to be underestimated. Because, you know, you will have your one thing also, I would say from experience, is that you are an extremely good researcher, I feel, when you are young. I don't know. There's something to do with age. Yes.
Patience, so, I guess.
Patience,
energy.
Energy, I think. Patience.
Also, yeah. I think when you grow old, you will have people to research for
you.
Yeah,
I guess. I don't know. I don't know how it works. Some psychologist has to take this out. Because when I was a younger lawyer, I used to enjoy researching.
Yeah.
But now you ask me, any law point comes to me and it takes me less than 30 seconds to just kind of take the intercom and, you know, tell my younger colleagues that, okay, you know, this is the law point, let's research.
Yeah.
Less research means that, you know, they are researching and they bring in and then, you know, I see the feasibility.
Yeah.
So therefore, so you have younger people who are, I personally feel that they are very enthusiastic about researching and good at it. So they do the research. Then, you know, there are most of the times, because in civil, again, there's a lot of strategy with the way you build up a case and so on. So, therefore, you want to do the drafting quite a bit yourself. So, but then you need an external. So, we have this conventional style of drafting where you don't type on your own. You actually dictate to the steno. Now, why that helps is also because I sometimes feel that sometimes when you're typing and you're thinking, because perhaps maybe I belong to the old school of thought. So, therefore, the thinking is getting a little reduced because here I'm talking about a lot long drafts.
Right.
Sometimes running into hundreds of pages.
Yeah.
So, therefore, like that. So, so that's another part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I come to the other aspect with regard to, the aspect of handling the matter. See, again, now when you have, suppose 10 matters listed in the next day, all 10 matters will not be for very high half an hour arguments.
Right.
There will be some matters in which there will be just, you know, pleadings getting completed, something getting filed, you know, a small objection to be taken or something. So then I guess what is very significant also for elder people in the chamber to train the younger people to go and appear in these matters.
Right.
So that also then maybe even these smallest of things, they learn something like called court craft,
mm-hmm.
as in how to appear, what to say, what not to say, and so on. And also, of course, get the confidence of appearing in the courts.
Right.
So, yes. So, therefore, a lot of effort required from everybody to help.
So, you make sure that like the more operational, vanilla type issues, the juniors can start taking up.
Yes.
And you kind of save your own time for
bigger. Yes, absolutely.
Complex.
Absolutely. Yeah, and not to be missed, the importance of a clerk.
Right.
In a law chamber.
Right.
That is very, very important.
Right.
Never to be underestimated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they do a lot of things. There's a lot of things which has to be done by a clerk, like the process fee, the this, the that.
Right, I'm sure.
There are a lot of things which so he's also equally important.
How was your journey like from starting from a young junior lawyer and then arguing matters? It must be an important day for a lawyer when you argue for the first time in the court.
Yeah, so Sharad, this is actually quite interesting that when I joined the profession, at that time, we would have a list of the High Court and the list was in my hand. And I am an early riser, so I enjoy getting up early and I enjoyed reading it. Okay, now I was to work with my dad. And he is an extreme, not because he's my father that I say that, but he's a great mentor,
mm-hmm.
But also a very serious lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So I could never ever in my whole life till now, till last 18 years, never asked him a frivolous question,
mm-hmm.
never. So that's not like a done thing. It's like for him, it will be like, you are asking this question as in why are you asking question?
Right.
So like that. So what I would say is that the first day perhaps I would have gone, or the first week when I would have gone, what I fairly remember is that I had read the matters which were listed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that stage, I could understand the intensity of the matters. Like I said that, you know, some matter, if I may grade them, say A being the most intense, B being a medium intense matter, C being an okay intense matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I perhaps offered to my father, the senior in the chamber, that I would want to do the C matter at least. And I would want to do it. I would want to argue.
Yeah.
And so I belong to, again, that time when we did not have that much of court exposure. Now I see interns, they come to our office also, they get court exposure. So I had gone to the court first time when I became a lawyer, when I was able to be at the band. So I remember his first reaction was that it's okay, you know, you're here for the rest of your life. So just take it easy, observe maybe for the first 1 month. So I said, no, I want to just go.
Yeah.
And I was, but I, howsoever confident I would have seemed at that time, inside of me, very frankly, I was very conscious of the fact that this is a very serious matter. Or even if, like, I just said that it was, let's say, that C kind of category. Mm. But still, like, you know, and, you know, if you are like 23, still you have to be very, very serious and completely into it. And I was able to do it quite all right, quite well. So then I slowly understood that perhaps arguing is my calling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And although very frankly, Nikhil, I enjoy every bit of my work, every bit of it. Even frankly, research also, if you ask me to do it, I'll just sit for a couple of hours and I'll do it.
Right.
So not a problem. But frankly, I enjoy arguing a lot and arguing the most. So my journey, I think, has evolved also as an arguing lawyer. Perhaps I've understood the way one should argue, the way I'm not saying, see, as a lawyer, the best thing is my grandfather lived till the age of 82.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was 82, he said, used to tell us that, you know, I'm still learning. And I cannot forget that sentence ever. So frankly, we as lawyers, we understand that, and we always should understand that we are learning each and every single day. So obviously the way I say argue or I think or I draft, I'm not saying that that's the best. As in, I think, obviously keep on improving tomorrow, day after,
yeah.
So on. But yes, I actually see my journey. I actually see that, yes, I have tried to, you know, acquire the art.
The growth kind of is visible, right?
Yes, I can see that.
Yeah.
In terms of the industry right now, we move to some business and sectoral things which are associated with the field. In terms of, do you see any major restructuring or structuring problems or anything that can be changed in the how the litigation set up or the legal framework is laid down? I mean, we just, just basically things like Nikhil and I have discussed, like with previous lawyers as well, like, you know, about how should we be protecting Indian law litigation firms also, or should we be open to international firms coming in terms of across, and even pay scales, right? Like there is something that again we discuss in terms of how the pay scales are so lopsided in this industry, more than you see in sort of other fast-paced professional services like banking or things like that.
Yeah.
Are there any other like?
So therefore, Sharad, I have a lot of things in my mind.
Yeah.
I would say that I have still not kind of started working on it per se, but yes, on a discussion level, at least I can kind of put forth, and you never know that maybe because, you know, your podcast goes all over the globe, it might just open up something.
Yeah.
So, the thing which, your question crystallizing it into just one answer, which I would like to give to that is that basically I feel that we definitely have to have many, 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 many more opportunities in the litigation field per se.
Okay.
Now, when I say that, I would like to explain it a little bit what I'm saying. See, the fact of the matter is that litigation is huge. Let me just look at Delhi for that matter, because like you said initially also, I'm a Delhi person.
Yeah.
So let me see Delhi. So Delhi, litigation, civil litigation, I'm not going into corporate. Look at the amount of people we have in Delhi. Every person, I don't mean that literally every person, but almost in every family, there is some kind of a dispute, whether it is property related, whether it is employment related, whether it is matrimony related, whether whatever it is. So imagine the amount of work which is there. Okay, now the quality of good lawyers would remain a little limited, you know. So, and like we just going back to what we just discussed till now, a law chamber, as simple as a law chamber, again, not going into the law firm dynamics and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Just a law chamber requires what? Requires drafting, requires research, requires, good strategy and this and that, requires client meeting and so on. So frankly, and now we have technology. So what I feel is, ask me if there are five researchers who can do great research for me, they might be just sitting anywhere across India, anywhere across the globe, but they can actually research on the law point which I have in mind. Why do I have to intercom the person sitting outside in the hall?
Mm-hmm.
I can just call that person or text him or her and say that you research this point by the next 3 hours and we are done.
Yeah.
So, and you imagine that the kind of, so he can, you know, earn because of the research what he does.
But that's not happening because the rules currently do not permit it? Or,
no, see.
Is it a question of supply or demand?
It's right. A question of not getting connected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's basically that I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So I also, so that's what I want is that, you know, the youngsters, see, everybody will not have the advantage of being a second generation, third generation lawyer and having the files, like I said.
Right.
So therefore, the first generation lawyers, they need to be encouraged the most. The youngsters, that is. Like, you know, my, just by my saying that, no, you must come to litigation. It's an amazing field and just do the hard work. Just be honest, just be dedicated and you'll see, you know, you'll flourish. But no, my saying is like empty words. What is required is that, you know, there has to be a connect with, you know, hardcore law chambers.
Right.
And people who are wanting to kind of give in a, be into that supply chain, you know, whether they want to give into, give you research work or perhaps, you know, come and I think when you're too young, then you can't really strategize, but you know, do something else, maybe, you know, come and do the basic drafting perhaps, I don't know.
But like, so like, I mean, that, if you kind of try to look at, I mean, like, obviously you kind of raise this point because you feel that is not happening.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
What do you think is a driver? Is it because the field is not, does not have the perception of being a lucrative area to get in?
Yeah.
Or is it a cultural issue that, you know, law firms, because I mean, I think law firms or any professional services, hierarchies are very clear from day one.
Yes.
There's a lot of formalization. Yes. You know, I mean, people are made to slog for quite some time before they're actually allowed to,
yeah,
you know, open up.
Yes.
For right reason, because yes, you need to develop that kind of a trust.
Right.
You know, when it comes to matters of such intensity,
yes,
or
yes,
criticality.
Right.
And youngsters are not able to get their head around that.
Right.
What exactly do you think is the reason why, you know, that might not be happening up to the mark?
So, you know, I think one prime reason which is not happening is that younger people are not really keenly looking into litigation.
Right.
So, I have one of my good friends and she's a litigating lawyer and she also goes and teaches in one of the good universities. And she was telling me rather, I think last month we had this conversation and she told me that, you know, I asked the class that now that when you finish law, so how many of you will come into litigation?
Right.
And I guess it was a class of 60 or 80 or whatever, that number. And I think maybe less than the fingers on our hand.
Oh, really?
Over, okay, the ones which were raised.
Right.
So therefore, I think one is that not very many people are coming into litigation.
Right.
And again, I'm talking about this kind of a normal domestic civil litigation.
Right.
Yes, international arbitration seems lucrative for the younger generation and things like that. So that's one aspect perhaps. And second, I guess, is see, that way industry is not one aspect, Nikhil, which will be very significant here is, which you said, and I also would want to reiterate, is that yes, there is a lot of trust factor, which is there. But what I was also wanting to say, that keeping that trust factor intact, trust between you and your client, that is, a law point can always be thought of, discussed, and so on. Because see, research is something which is very, very, very significant in the field of law. Law is something which keeps on evolving.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, you know, there's a saying, Roscoe Pound used to say that law is stable, but law needs to change.
Yeah.
And actually law changes, and that too very beautifully. So therefore, maybe we can involve the younger generation only, say till the research level, because then you see, if you give a person research on a law point, the person doesn't even know what the case is about.
Right.
And then if you feel later on the person is trustworthy, maybe you can involve the person in the case and so on and so forth.
Right.
So like that. So those kind of things can be done. Definitely. You know,
right,
this is the next way forward in the profession of law. I really feel so.
And you know, also, I guess, you know, one thing that I'm living sort of in the West and working in capital markets. And
yeah.
I think a key trend that you notice is that, you know, talent usually chases, young talent chases where the high pay packages,
yes,
are.
Yes, absolutely.
Like compensation,
yeah,
irrespective of what, you know, I don't think people in that age bracket even have, think super long term.
Yes.
They get attracted to,
yes,
which is,
yes,
highest, right? I mean,
yes,
and is that sort of, also a factor, like in
terms
that's, of
comps
being lucrative?
Yes, yes, Sharat, you're right. That is a factor. So if that factor remains as it would remain, like it's seeming like, then I think what could happen is that litigating lawyers like myself and like many, many of my very learned colleagues, so, you know, we will then become very, very precious, perhaps, I think, because then, you know, there will be not so very many people who would be wanting to do law with that kind of a passion, with that kind of a thing. I feel that also.
Right.
You know, that is also something which we kind of discuss when we stand in the corridors and, you know, that, okay, so young generation every day is dwindling into the litigation field. Yes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Like if you kind of take a step aside in terms of, you know, like you mentioned when you give a case study, you mentioned a property matter. I assume you were dealing with a lot of property matters,
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you look at like a typical civil dispute resolution, say from the, you know, perspective of like a family property issue.
That's right.
I'm assuming that takes a fair bit of your bandwidth.
Yes.
So I think it would be really good because this is something very, which I think anyone who's listening in would be able to identify with, you know, it's something which is very relevant to one's personal life.
Yeah.
What are the legal frameworks out there,
you
know, in terms of looking at family related issues, be it property, be it you know, marital problems, like where does the journey for a person start there in the context of the unfortunate incident that there is some sort of an issue which has cropped up?
Absolutely. Beautiful question, Nikhil. So basically, property becomes a major issue, especially you rightly use the word unfortunate issue. So first I would like to talk about succession. Succession is something which is very, very significant in terms of the Indian laws. We are governed by the Hindu Succession Act, basically, of which I would like to discuss, is basically that when somebody dies, then succession opens. So first I would like to explain the, because, you know, Hindu Succession Act talks about a Hindu male differently and Hindu female differently. But I would also want to explain to the listeners that female have equal rights. So I would want to start with that. Perhaps there might be some listeners who might be not thinking that way or might be assuming that perhaps they are lesser in rights, but that's not how it is. So that will also come to like your economics or your finance thing, that what we also used to learn in way back in economics honors, that, you know, your empowerment is as per how economically empowered you are.
Right.
So the beautiful aspect is actually that women are equally empowered.
Right.
So now I come back to my succession point. So therefore, basically, let me say, I assume a case where a male Hindu dies. Now, there are two things which are there. One is that he has made a will. And obviously, when he makes a will, he can choose any, leave any, and so on and so forth, personal relationships with the person, which the person had with his family members. Then there are very, very, very many cases where there is no will.
Right.
So when there is no will, I would like to take an example of, say, a family of four. I'll keep it as simple as that. There was a male Hindu, his wife, and his two children. I take the children for explanation, one daughter and one son.
Sure.
So everybody gets 1/3 share. That's what succession says.
Right.
So therefore, where does it...
In the absence of a will.
In the absence of a will, absolutely. Because then you get governed by the act. And so where does the dispute actually arise? The dispute arises when one of the person who is inheriting, one of the legal heirs, is not wanting that the other two have 1/3. So sometimes, you know, he purports some kind of an other, if I may use the word, quote unquote, story or something like that. And that's when the dispute starts.
But I mean, it seems like there's a fair amount of clarity in the law at this point.
Yes.
So, I mean, is it like, say, then it's a case of no, a will actually was created? Like, what are the kind of ways in which disputes actually originate?
How can you counter it, I guess?
Yeah,
right?
So how does it... So therefore, you know, we have had cases like this where, you know, suddenly out of the... So if one of the family members has come to us saying that, you know, this is how it has happened and I am 1/3 shareholder... And so straight away you go in for a suit for partition, saying that, yes, let's partition the property 1/3, 1/3, 1/3. And the smoothest of the case will be where the other two people are made defendants. But in partition suit, you always say that plaintiff and defendant are at equal footing.
Right.
And therefore, that's a case where you actually don't have to pay much of a court fee.
Right.
But then, so if the defendants are agreeable, the other two members,
right.
And then, you know, it's one third, court decree, you get it in your favor and the property gets divided.
Right.
But then there is another case where suddenly one of the legal heirs will come up with this will that, no, the father had done this will. So
okay.
Then, you know, then the issue gets created with regard to the will.
Right.
And when that issue is created, then of course, then the trial happens, whether the will is a forged will, whether the will is a true will, and evidence gets adduced on that.
Right.
And there, you know, you have to have, again, very in-depth knowledge of the Indian Evidence Act and how you prove a will, how you disprove a will. And that's how that dispute goes on. But here, I would also want to add, Nikhil, which is very important, is something called the HUF, which you would have perhaps heard in your daily parlance. Yeah, Hindu undeveloped family. And there, what happens is that there is where the women actually got a lot of rights after 2005.
Right.
So we have the Succession Act of 1956, the Hindu Succession Act. And according to that, the lady, if she was the member of the HUF, she was not getting, so the member of an HUF in law parlance is called a kopasna.
Right.
So the kopasna was only the male descendants.
Right.
Till 2005. 2005, we got an amendment. Again, the law is very beautifully written there. So the amendment said that now the woman is also a kopasna. So once the woman was a kopasna, so just imagine a huge family tree. I'm not talking now again of just a simple family of four, but like a huge family tree where there are uncles and so on and so forth. And there is a female descendant right there, say an only child of a parent. So she has a right in the grandfather's property as per the HUF. So that's where the law really got developed. And in fact, she can ask for partition. So that was something which was a complete no before 2005.
Right.
But after 2005, yes, she could even ask for partition of her HUF property. So therefore, the law got really, I would say the law has really evolved. That's why even in my initial part, I was saying that law is evolving and should evolve and is evolving as per the times, I would say. So, and therefore, so, you know, what happens is that people read these days, it's easier to know some of your rights through Google also and so on. So therefore, people read, people understand that they have rights. So that's why they kind of want to rush to a lawyer. Such a situation happened, whether a woman or a man. That, okay, what are our rights, what can we ask for, and so on and so forth. That's how it happens.
Unfortunately, Google can be a double-edged sword, right?
Oh, yes, yes.
They must be thinking they can argue on your behalf as well.
Yeah, so that's what...
I think that's a doctor, that's a doctor
so
metaphor
that's
which comes out.
That's a statutory warning which has to come with that. So you can't really...
doctors and lawyers, absolutely.
Yes, you need a lawyer,
hate Google.
Yeah, for the record, you need a lawyer.
You're the only one I think I've heard who said something positive about Google. To start with, at least.
Lawyer. I start on a positive.
Absolutely. But you know, it's interesting because when you were mentioning like a Hindu unified family or you know, the lack of a succession plan, and I assume a lot of the cases will be there where there's no will.
Yes.
Right. And I like, we often discuss, like, we obviously look at this more from a financial services perspective.
Of course. Yes.
We often you know, discuss that how come, you know, like I came in from the UK. UK estate planning is a massive space of its own.
Yeah.
And you know, there are like, you know, companies who do this full time, who actually, you know,
big companies,
who you know, value your assets and, you know, make sure that you have a very, very legally verifiable succession plan.
That's right.
Do you see some developments in that area? Like, do you see not from the perspective of the industry, but like over 18 years, have you started noticing that more and more people actually now have wills? Or I mean, have you made some, like, do you have some
judgment call or
positivity on that regard?
Yes.
Or you think, no, the world which doesn't have wills and succession plans is still pretty good for your business, but I mean, like, just from a perspective of an observer, what do you think?
I would definitely say, Nikhil, people do make wills. We get this very, very regularly.
Right.
I think people of our generation who are in their 40s are very hopeful that they will live very long, so they don't come to us for wills. But yes, there are a lot of people who are in their 60s who come to us for wills regularly.
Right.
And wills can be also video filmed these days.
Okay.
And then the will can be registered as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Okay, now again, besides that, so there are wills, and wills get probated in the court. That's kind of the law on the wills.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to seek a probate. So when you seek a probate, again, all the other legal heirs are called to the court. So I have seen this as a practice, or that many a times the will gets disputed.
Right.
So, therefore, coming back again to the succession law, that in spite of the fact that, yes, definitely there is a spurt of wills, there is. What I would have seen in 2002, what I see in 2020 is completely different scenario.
Right.
I see very many wills being structured, being formulated, being there, being registered. But still, the dispute with regard to the wills continues.
Right.
So, and so that's something which perhaps is the reason that the disputes with regard to succession also continue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I guess, you know, people realizing more and more, there's layers of sophistication that people are adding into their lives,
yes,
as well, right? And
yeah,
to streamline their process. And people,
yes,
are, as you said, are reading a lot now.
Yes.
So they understand how to equip,
yeah,
themselves better.
Yes.
What are some questions that Nikhil and I often ask most people who come? What keeps you up at night? And, you know, in a litigator's case, I guess, you know, you're obviously thinking about all your cases all the time. But
yeah,
fundamentally, is there something that bothers you within the legal framework which you think, you know, needs to be addressed, or something that, you know, just keeps you up at night?
Yeah. So basically, to answer your question, Sharad, actually, very, very directly answering the question, I really don't keep up at night, in the sense that
you sleep well.
As in, I'm not, I will obviously
go. You're working too hard. So.
Yeah. So I actually get to sleep in,
yeah,
half a second.
Right.
So it's really easy for me to drop down to sleep, because at the end of the day, as a litigating lawyer, I feel very satisfied, because whatever you may say, whatever you may read, I don't know what kind of message goes to the outside world. At the end of the day, you really, really, as a litigating lawyer, if you're completely into it, you feel that you've really got something for your client every,
right,
single day.
Right.
There's something, and you are able to have a change in their lives. And when you see that change, I can't tell you, it's you feel really at the top of the world, really. Right. As in, you feel as if something has changed in your own life. You know,
right,
that's how actually you feel at the end of the day. And now, because the span has gone to these 18 years, and obviously I have had... I've heard stories of some clients who have been there, you know, generational clients also, of course, we have, whose grandfather used to come to my grandfather for justice.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have seen those people actually financially rise because of perhaps one case which you won for them.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
so you can understand the satisfying feeling,
yeah,
which you,
yeah,
have. But having said that, now coming to the ethos of your question, therefore, what actually kind of keeps me up or keeps me thinking all the time is basically, again, what I also mentioned a little bit in the middle was that I want to as much encourage the younger generation. I don't know why I consider it my responsibility, but I want to encourage them.
Mm-hmm.
And because perhaps, you know, as a lawyer, although you are quite very focused on your matters, but you are also perhaps, because you're dealing so emotionally with people, you are very emotional at times.
Right.
You won't believe, Sharad, that if somebody would have appreciated me in 2005 after I argued a matter, say, for an hour at length, I still remember that appreciation.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know whether it happens to everybody, but it does happen to me. So similarly, I want to have that similar thing, in the sense that sometimes I see a young lawyer arguing and getting a beautiful order, and I'm sitting, you know, in the same courtroom on one of the chairs. I actually make it a point, I go to him or her and I tell them that wonderfully done. So, you know, so like in all ways whatsoever, I do not know whether you've seen my LinkedIn posts. I've just started when
I have.
So my 18th year, I felt, you know, because I used to always feel that I want to say this to them. I want to say this to them. Sometimes good things, sometimes to kind of not little lecturing.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good word to use. So sometimes I like to kind of tell them, to explain them that how it is. So then I thought that I would not be able to talk to every youngster who crosses the corridor,
yeah,
and perhaps sometimes, you know, you are occupied in your thoughts and in your matter. So I thought that this is the way perhaps I can reach out to them, and I can, you know, tell them that this is, these are the certain decorums, this is the way, this is the, you know, whatever would just cross my mind. Then besides that, I would also want to say that what is very, very, very close to my heart is access to justice.
Right.
And so in whichever possible way, in whichever simplest of manner, I can do that. Whether, you know, sometimes the honorable courts, if they appoint me as amicus, I try to do as much as I can for the client, so that, you know, I'm able to get them great relief. And, you know, be part of the legal aid, do things like that.
Right.
Because that's something, again, which comes, again, on the responsibility bit. And so that's also very, very significant, I feel. And I also thirdly would like to say that I feel personally that court is always the last resort.
Right.
So nobody wants to come there, and it's really something which a person wants to avoid till the last.
Right.
So also kind of a message to my younger friends that please imagine the pain of your client. As in you, we have to be in the client's shoes to a certain extent, as in you kind of echo their feelings or their pain in the court. So
but try to understand that. But like are you saying that because you feel there is a there's a moral hazard that there's a tendency of a lot of lawyers to take you to court ASAP? Do you see that, or it's just something that you feel is something that from an empathy perspective people should consider?
Yeah, from an empathy perspective,
right.
And yes, from that also, like what you said initially, I would say that, you know, there are, in fact, I just want to touch this for a minute.
Sure.
And that is mediation, because that's also something which is very commendable, which is happening in Delhi. Delhi High Court Mediation Center is amazing. And there are a lot of matters which can get referred to mediation. And again, talking about succession and these kind of property matters, family matters. So while the matter is being argued in the courts, there are times when the parties understand that there's no point in litigating.
So
it's
just like another forum where you can get it done quickly.
So yes, so mediation is like, you know, obviously like in the legal parlance itself, it's a win-win situation.
Right.
So
right.
I would always again urge everybody, like my younger friends also, if a matter is getting settled in mediation, be the first one to get it done.
Right.
Because, you know, the flow of matters will always remain for a litigating lawyer. If you're a good lawyer, you will always have work. So,
right.
So this is never going to be a dearth. Your matter is getting over, get the relief for the client. At the end of the day, that's what really matters.
Right.
Yeah.
The client should feel that, yes, he came to you and he's relieved.
Right.
Yeah.
I think we're good on time, but I have one I would say final question here.
Yes.
And I think that's something which might be useful for a lot of the listeners. Like you obviously mentioned in the beginning, like from a succession perspective, like women actually have equal, right?
That's right.
I'm pretty sure there are a lot of myths.
Yeah.
Which a lot of, you know,
or clients, fake news as we call it.
Clients must be, you know, like there must be presumptions, wrong presumptions or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you might be clarifying it that the law provides a provision.
Yeah.
Is there anything else like within family matters or within, you know, marital matters, which is a very common myth that you think should be addressed?
Oh, yes. So, Nikhil, if we have the time, I'll maybe try to shorten it.
Sure. Yeah.
But I'll just explain this.
Absolutely.
Myths are too many, in fact. you know, because again, whatever the reasons are for the myths.
Google, obviously.
okay, I don't say any reason, but whatever the reasons are, but there are myths.
Right.
So one myth is that, you know, one very olden thought which is going on is that, you know, if there are two or three daughter-in-laws in a house, the daughter-in-law, I assume one daughter-in-law has only sons, one daughter-in-law has a son and a daughter, and one daughter-in-law has only daughters. So the daughter-in-law who has only daughters used to think that, okay, her rights are little lesser than her co-sisters. Mm-hmm. So that is a myth.
Yeah.
Right.
You A, B and C are all equal.
Right.
If you have a daughter or if you have a son, in the HUF property, you do not have lesser rights. In a self-acquired property also, you do not have lesser rights. So therefore, meaning thereby, every woman in the Hindu law has equal rights when it comes to property. There is absolutely no lesser rights. Because let me just crystallize it to 3 points. Number one, self-acquired property of parents, equal rights of a daughter and a son. Number two, HUF property, you are a co-partner, a woman is a co-partner, so equal rights like the brothers. Then third, a woman earlier did not have a right for partition, but now she can seek partition as well.
Right.
So after the 2005 amendment, so she has that right as well. So she has all the rights. When you are a girl sibling, you have all the rights as your boy sibling.
Right, yeah.
So there is so that myth has to go.
Right.
So that is one very, very important. I'm quite glad that you asked this question.
I think our listeners have got some free legal advice.
We've
got some.
Absolutely. And you know, we are kind of ending this podcast on a rather optimistic note.
Yeah, we are.
We generally end things on a very cynical note.
Oh,
so,
my God.
if not much cynicism comes from the guests, then we add it. But there is too much positivity in the room right now. So I'm not going to, you know, dampen that.
Yeah, but please don't. I'm a very positive person. Yeah,
absolutely not. No, thank you so much, Sonali, for spending your time and for some very valuable insights.
Thanks, Nikhil. Thanks, Sharath.
I'm sure a lot of our listeners would... it will resonate with a lot of them.
Yeah, no, it was a very useful chat, and I personally learned a bunch of new things. I'm sure our listeners as well, there'll be many more like me who learn a bunch of new things. So thanks for your time.
Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thanks.
And yeah, so to all our listeners, obviously feel free to drop in your comments, give your feedback to this particular episode, to the series in general. If there are any guests who would like to, potential guests who would like to come over, just give us a shout. We'll be happy to host you here. And lastly, if you have any comments on how to make this a better podcast, do let us know. Thank you very much. And this is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharath Tupran
signing off.